civilians in Gaza today. Many people were killed, and U.S. officials are pressing Israel for details. That story is next on All Things Considered after the newscasts and after your KQED traffic update starting in the Altamont Pass. Here's Julie Deppish.
And we have a traffic alert for this overturned vehicle eastbound 580 after North Flynn in the center divide. But emergency crews are in the left lane. Traffic just barely moving back to First Street Livermore. Back to the peninsula, northbound 101 before San Bruno Avenue. Three right lanes remain blocked with that crash. The stop back to Broadway. And an entry crash, Sunnyvale still there. Westbound 237 after the 101 split. Taking up the left lane, solid from Lawrence Expressway. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie's next update is at 518. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highland, Sacramento. It's 5 o'clock.
Until a war zone.
Israel dropped a bomb on a school in Gaza, which it said was being used by Hamas. NPR has discovered that the bomb was made by the U.S.
For Thursday, June 6th, it's All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We'll share interviews with D-Day veterans over the years.
It was bouncing around, waves blowing over the side. It wasn't long before all of us aboard that little boat were seasick.
Also, we meet the woman at the center of a dispute between the wife of Justice Alito and their liberal neighbors.
And one couple who loves to fish wound up with a surprising big catch, a big old wad of money.
It was just a big old stack brick of money on a regular rubber band. And I think the first thing I said to me, I was like, babe, money, life is about to change.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A moment of reflection on the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Crowds gathered in Normandy, France for emotional commemorations of an event that was a crucial turning point in World War II. Today's ceremonies also served as a moment for President Biden and others to connect the liberation of Europe from Nazi domination to NATO's fight against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
Ceremony on Omaha Beach, European leaders and royalty, including Britain's Prince William, shook each veteran's hand and thanked them for what they'd done. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had especially emotional exchanges with several of the veterans, squatting down to hug and talk with them in their wheelchairs. One veteran called him a hero of the people.
Nous vous faisons chevalier de la Légion d'honneur.
President Emmanuel Macron of France awarded the French Legion of Honor to 15 American veterans. The crowd applauded as the aging men struggled to stand so the medal could be pinned to their chest. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Normandy.
Jurors in Hunter Biden's federal gun trial in Delaware heard testimony from five government witnesses today. That includes a central witness in the case, Holly Biden, the widow of Hunter brother Beau. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
Holly Biden and Hunter Biden had a romantic relationship for several years after Beau Biden's death in 2015. Over nearly 3 hours on the witness stand in front of a packed courtroom, she told jurors about Hunter Biden's use of crack cocaine and how he introduced her to the drug, a period in her life that she said she was ashamed of. This case revolves around Hunter's drug use and his alleged lies about it when he bought a gun in October of 2018. Jurors heard from Hallie Biden how in October of that year, she found the gun in Hunter's truck and how she threw it away in a trash can outside of a grocery store where it was later found. Prosecutors say they expect to call two more witnesses Friday before resting their case. Ryan Lucas, NPR News. Wilmington, Delaware.
The British Court of Appeal has said it will hear a challenge from Prince Harry focused on his security. As Villa Marx reports, it follows a decision by the government to curtail his security support whenever he visits Britain.
A government committee ruled in 2020 that Harry, the youngest son of King Charles, was no longer entitled to police bodyguards like other senior royals after he moved to California and gave up his royal duties. He challenged the lawfulness of that decision, but in February, the London High Court upheld it. Now, though, a Court of Appeal judge has said he will hear his legal team's arguments, though, quote, not without hesitation.
Reporter Willem Marks. The average rate on a 30-year mortgage came down a bit this week, falling below 7%, though it's only slight relief for would-be home buyers who are also still looking at low inventories and relatively high home prices. The average rate on a 30-year mortgage fell to 6.99%. A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 78 points. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Tara Seiler. California's Attorney General settled a lawsuit against three ghost gun manufacturers this week, barring the companies from manufacturing or selling the kits in the state. KQED's Aaron Baldessari reports.
So-called ghost gun kits are used to assemble weapons at home and are typically sold without serial numbers or background checks. California's Department of Justice says the number of ghost guns recovered by law enforcement has ballooned from just 26 in 2015 to more than 12,000 in 2021. The state's lawsuit alleged three companies sold the kits in California without complying with state law, including failing to perform background checks. The companies admitted no wrongdoing, but agreed to pay fines ranging from $55,000 to $500,000. I'm Erin Baldessari, KQED News.
San Francisco could soon begin soliciting private donations to cover the costs of hosting two Chinese pandas at the city zoo. The zoo will need to pay an estimated $25 million toward a new panda enclosure, leading residents to express concerns about the cost. Animal rights activists also question whether the zoo is up for the task, given recent allegations of mismanagement. Fleur Dawes with the group In Defense of Animals spoke today at a committee hearing on the plan.
The zoo has repeatedly proven it is incapable of handling major infrastructure projects which drag on for years while animals suffer in temporary holding.
Mayor Lyndon Breed is seeking an exemption from city ethics rules so she can seek donations for the Panda Project from people who have business before the city. The Board of Supervisors will discuss the request at next week's meeting. I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Details at CapitalOne.com and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. Visitors can explore the wonders of California and see how big, bold, and biodiverse nature can be at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. Tickets at calacademy.org. 62 degrees right now in San Francisco. In Oakland, it's 67. San Jose, 84. The current temperature in Sacramento is 96 degrees. This is KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Israeli military dropped a U.S.-made bomb onto a United Nations school compound in Gaza, sheltering thousands of displaced civilians earlier today. Israel said it was targeting a group of militants at the school. The director of a Gaza hospital says dozens of people, including children, were killed in the strike. NPR photographed fragments of the bomb, and a Pentagon official says that Israel used the device improperly. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us from Tel Aviv. Daniel, can you just start by walking us through the strike today? What exactly happened?
Israel's army says this was around 2 a.m. this morning. It was targeting a group of militants. Some of them, the army says, participated in the October 7th attack on southern Israel, which sparked this war. And the army says that the military called off the strike twice before to minimize collateral damage and that it did go ahead with the strike anyway. And according to the director of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza, at least 32 people, including seven children, were killed in this strike. The UN says 6,000 civilians who were displaced in the war were sheltering in the school where this strike took place. And our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, visited the hospital morgue. He saw a body bag labeled as containing the body parts of five children. And he also visited the UN school that was struck. He saw children in the courtyard with injuries. He saw UN workers cleaning up the debris.
This was a playground yard that were sheltering many people here in a tent before, but now it turned into like a war zone.
And they also videotaped parts of the bomb that were still left there at the school. There were serial numbers on these parts, on these shrapnel bits. And so we asked weapons experts to identify what the bomb was.
And Daniel, what were you all able to learn about the type of weaponry that Israel used in the strike?
It was a GBU-39 small diameter bomb. This is according to a Pentagon official and a former U.S. Air Force official who looked at the images that our producer took. This is the same kind of bomb, Juana, that, according to reporting by the New York Times, was used by Israel in a recent airstrike, you may recall, that killed dozens of displaced civilians in Gaza at a tent camp. This was a strike that the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, called a tragic mishap. Now, the Pentagon official I spoke with said that in the strike today, Israel used the bomb improperly. The official said the bomb is intended to cause low collateral damage, but instead it caused a high number of casualties and was used in a school where Israel knew that there were many people sheltering there. I also spoke to a former U.S. Air Force official, Wes Bryant, who said that the U.S. military would have most likely called off such a strike if it were up to them, where you have militants holed up in a U.N. school, but you also have displaced civilians there. And U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller is now calling on Israel to be fully transparent about this strike and to name the people who were killed in it.
So, Daniel, at this point, how is Israel responding to these charges?
Well, the Israeli military has so far put out 9 names of people they say were militants in Hamas and Islamic Jihad and put out their photos, said those were people who were killed in the strike and that they're still identifying others. Israel says that these militants should not have been operating inside classrooms and that they were planning attacks on Israelis. Israel says we stopped a ticking time bomb. But unlike the strike a few weeks ago, which Israel has called a tragic mishap, the army has made no mention of civilians killed in this strike. The Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari said, "We will pursue anyone who took part in the massacre of October 7th.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right now, on the southern U.S. border, most migrants seeking asylum at ports of entry are being turned back. This comes just 2 days after the implementation of President Biden's executive action intended to stop illegal crossings into the U.S. The Biden administration says border enforcement agencies are severely underfunded and agents are overwhelmed. But now, immigration agents will be able to determine more quickly whether a migrant has a legal basis to remain in the country. With us now to explain is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran, who covers immigration. Hi, Sergio.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so how exactly is this rule changing what immigration officials do at the border?
Right. So the stated goal of this rule is to expedite screenings and removals. And Border Patrol agents who are already on the front lines will play a key role in meeting this goal. But it doesn't drastically change what agents have been doing all this time. That's what Rodney Scott, who served as the chief of the Border Patrol under former President Trump and President Biden, says.
So Border Patrol specifically, their job is to make sure that no one sneaks into our national home in between the ports of entry. So regardless of what that person claims later, what their nationality is, how tall they are, you know, it's all irrelevant. They cross the border illegally. Border Patrol has to respond, has to take them into custody, fingerprint them, take some biographical information, and then process them administratively.
The one thing that is new is that in the past, an immigration official would ask a migrant whether they feared persecution or torture if they were to be deported. Mm-hmm. Now, agents won't have to ask that. The burden would fall on immigrants. They'd have to manifest a fear of persecution. And the new rules also raises the criteria to demonstrate credible fear.
Okay, but the Biden administration says that this new policy could help ease the burden, right, on Border Patrol mm-hmm. agents. Can you just explain their side of all of this?
Right. I mean, the southern border has seen a high number of asylum seekers over the last few years, and that has meant that Border Patrol agents have had to spend hours processing all those claims. I talked to Victor Manjarres, the former chief patrol agent of the El Paso and Tucson sectors. He served under Democratic and Republican administrations, and he says this could be the one thing that can free up Border Patrol agents to pay attention to illegal crossings and drug trafficking.
So the processing time, if the asylum number is capped, goes down for the agents. And you have the ability to go back on the field. That's the problem right now.
The executive order kicks in when encounters with unauthorized migrants at the border reach an average of 2,500 in a week. Only migrants with exceptional circumstances, unaccompanied minors, and victims of severe forms of trafficking would be allowed to claim asylum.
And just to be clear, Sergio, this rule, it doesn't shut down the border, right? Or eliminate asylum.
Right, it does not. Right? Yeah. Biden says the U.S. will continue to honor international agreements, and migrants could still claim asylum. They just have to get an appointment via the CBP One app, something that's pretty hard. It's a lottery system, and there are only about 1,500 appointments a day.
Well, I am curious, what have the people you've talked to said about putting a cap on illegal crossings? Like, do they think it will help achieve what the Biden administration wants here?
Well, they are skeptical about how effective that could be. Manjarres, an immigrant rights advocate, say the cap will push migrants to more remote areas in order to skirt Border Patrol agents. And in the hot summer months when temperatures reaches over 100 degrees, that could result in deaths. And that could pose an additional challenge for the government.
That is NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you so much, Sergio.
You're welcome.
Some couples like to hike or cook together. For James Cain and Barbie Augustini, they fish with magnets.
They have caught coins, weapons, old tools. But you know, last week, they hit the jackpot in a lake in Flushing Meadows, Corona Park in Queens, New York.
When I got the click on the something heavy in the water, and you could tell what it's going to be once it does come out of the water because it's, you know, it's a rusty square. And I said, babe, we got a safe. We got a safe.
That safe was loaded with soggy $100 bills.
It was just a big old stack brick of money on a regular rubber band. And I think the first thing I said, I was like, babe, money. Life is about to change.
Augustini couldn't believe it.
I didn't take him serious. I thought it was a joke, you know? We like to have fun when we're out because we're out for hours at a time. So I just thought he was playing a little joke on me.
The bills weren't in the best condition, but they were legit, and the couple expects to end up with $50,000 to $80,000.
The first thing I noticed when I peeled some of them back, first of all, the money is like a big melted, slimy, browny, melted gook of mud and a really bad stench.
They called the police, who checked the money and said the bills were so delicate that they couldn't be reviewed for evidence of crime.
They were so in shock that they wanted pictures with us because some people, 20 years of working, they never heard anything like this before.
Yeah. Yeah. They said that the safe itself was obviously a product of crime because there was the hole in the back, but there was no crime, like, from us.
So the couple was free to claim it. Cain and Augustini plan to take the money to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing here in Washington, D.C., where the bills can be recovered.
And what will they do with their find once it's ready to be spent?
I've always wanted to have a place where I can, like, raise chickens and goats, have lots of dogs running around, and this kind of fell into our lap, so maybe this will allow us to get there.
Well, if you want to explore the joys of magnet fishing, Cain has some advice for you to get started.
You need a very strong magnet, not the little ones for $20, $30, unfortunately, on Amazon. And also throw really far. I'd like to tell everyone, swing for the fence. If you know how to swing, like you played baseball or something like that, you need to swing it far.
Swing for the fences. Elsa, are you ready to go fishing?
Oh, I am so ready, Juana.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Supreme Court Justice Alito's neighbor talks about her unpleasant run-in with Mrs. Alito next on All Things Considered after your KQED traffic update, starting with the continuing trouble at the Altamont Pass. Here's Julie Depesh.
They are still dealing with that overturned vehicle to East 580 after North Flynn. The left lane blocked. It's a major backup into Livermore to North Livermore Avenue now. Sunnyvale crash, injuries involved here. Westbound 237 after the 101 interchange. They blocked the left lane, solid from Lawrence Expressway. And somebody ran out of gas in San Bruno, northbound 280 after Sneath Lane. That vehicle in the right lane causing delays from San Bruno Avenue. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Graham's Port, family owned and operated for over 200 years, available at vintageandfinewines.com or at local fine wine retailers and restaurants throughout California. And from visitorscoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra joined the Biden administration just as the COVID vaccine was rolling out. The former California Attorney General had little health background, and he had a wobbly start. We'll talk with him about issues ranging from cannabis policy to abortion, health disparities, and climate change as a health issue. It's Political Breakdown tonight at 6:30 on KQED Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ronan Farrow on how his reporting on the Me Too movement led to the criminal case against Donald Trump. Farrow unearthed details of the National Enquirer's plan to pay for damaging stories about Trump and then bury those stories. The connection between that practice and the 2016 election gave prosecutors a felony case against Trump. Join us.
Tune in for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. Support for NPR comes from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR and the listeners of KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This next story starts small, a neighborhood fight over lawn signs, but it goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The New York Times recently reported that conservative Justice Samuel Alito had an upside-down flag flying in front of his home about a week after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. It raised a lot of questions, which Alito answered by saying this was about a political dispute between his wife and their liberal neighbors. NPR's Tom Dreisbach spoke to the neighbor at the center of the fight.
Like a lot of things about life in America today, this whole story was really only possible because of COVID. Emily Baden was working as an actor and restaurant server in New York when the once-in-a-century pandemic shut the country down. So she and her husband moved in with her mom in suburban D.C. And her mom just happened to live down the street from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito and his wife, Martha Ann. Now, Justice Alito is firmly on the political right. Emily Baden, on the other hand...
I describe myself as a leftist.
At first, Baden did not think much of the Alitos. They lived several houses down. You can't even see their place from her mom's front yard. Then Joe Biden won the 2020 election, and Baden put up a handmade sign in the yard. On one side, it said, "By Don," get it? And on the other, it said, paraphrasing the curse word for the radio here, "F Trump." One day, Martha Ann Alito happens to drive by.
Pulls up in her car, says, "Thank you for taking the sign down."
But she actually did not take it down. The wind had knocked it over, and she was not about to leave it down.
And I say, "I'm going to keep the sign up. Thank you. Bye."
Then came the January 6th attack on the Capitol. It's important to remember just how tense things were at the time. The Capitol had barbed wire around it, troops in camouflage on the streets of D.C. On their block, Baden put up a new sign. "Trump is a fascist" on one side, and "You are complicit" on the other. So on the morning of January 7th, Baden and her husband are parked in front of their house.
This car pulls up and then stops next to us. And the person inside just stares at us, just glares at us. And I was just sitting there like, you know, thinking to myself, "Oh my God, that's Mrs. Alito. That's her." And, you know, she's stopped there for a period of time that feels like forever and then drives off.
Baden texted some friends like, "Can you believe what just happened?" About a week or so after this, the American flag flying in front of the Alito home gets turned upside down. For sailors, this is considered a distress signal. But at that particular time, it was also a symbol that supporters of the pro-Trump quote-unquote Stop the Steal movement used to protest Joe Biden's win. Some Trump supporters flew upside-down flags at the Capitol riot. For what it's worth, Emily Baden never actually saw the Alito's flag. Other neighbors did, and they later sent pictures to the New York Times. Then comes Inauguration Day 2021. Baden says she and her husband are curious about what's going on over at the Alito's, so they drive by.
I don't know if I expected to see anything or what I expected to see.
Martha Ann Alito was out front.
She sees us and runs out to the street. And she's yelling something, and we don't hear it. Our windows are up, and we're in motion, so we don't hear what she's yelling.
Now, the street is a cul-de-sac, so they have to actually turn around and go drive back by the house a second time. And this time, she says she saw Martha Ann Alito talking to the security detail, gesturing at them.
And we see in our rearview mirror that she, like, spits at our car, or it looks like she spat at our car. And then we just got the hell out of there.
Spits from how far away?
Well, we're in motion, so it probably, I'm sure that it didn't hit our car.
This was all just leading up to one more incident a few weeks later. And by all accounts, it was a lot more intense. It's February 15th, 2021.
My husband and I are just in the driveway. We're getting the trash cans. And then the Alitos walk up. They presumably were just taking a walk. And it's sort of a blind corner, so we didn't really see them coming. And then Mrs. Alito says something like, well, 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 if it isn't the fascists, Emily, and my husband's name and my mom's name, you're a fascist.
Baden says she was kind of freaked out. She says Alito had used their full names, but they'd never actually introduced themselves. And at the time, she and her husband weren't married, didn't even have the same name.
Why do you know personal details about us? And that was when I spoke back and I said, I did obviously use an expletive.
That expletive was the C word.
But I also said a lot of other things, like, how dare you behave this way? You're a Supreme Court Justice of the United States. And that now I'm addressing Mr. Alito, who was there and did not intervene in her behavior, which I took note of.
The Alitos walked away as Baden yelled at them.
And Mr. Alito is walking away much quicker because I think, yeah, he really got out of there.
Do you regret cursing at all?
I guess I would say that I regret it. You know, the power imbalance between these people and myself is huge. Like, it literally couldn't get any bigger. And they're choosing to harass and intimidate us when we are nothing to them. We're just random people. And yeah, so that would have been the message that I wanted to convey. And if, you know, and if a curse word cheapened that somehow, then yeah, I would say that I regretted saying it.
Right after this happened, Baden's husband actually called the cops. The officer who answered told them basically, it's not illegal to yell at your neighbors. But he said he would call the Alito's protective detail. Baden actually recorded that call to have a record of what happened.
So what will happen, okay, if it does happen again, she's causing issues as far as for whatever. She's in your guys' yard, she's yelling at you guys, it's a problem that's happening right then and there. Call us back, we'll see if we can come out and handle it then on scene, okay?
And that was the last time Emily Baden or her husband interacted with the Alitos. But then last month, the New York Times reported about the upside-down flag. Democrats said that flying a symbol associated with Trump meant Justice Alito should recuse from cases related to January 6th. Alito rejected those arguments. He wrote a letter to Congress saying that his wife alone was responsible for flying the flag upside down. He claims he asked her to take it down, and she refused for several days. He also wrote that his wife's reasons for flying the flag upside down are, quote, not relevant for present purposes. And then he described the dispute with Emily Baden and her husband, and the use of the C word. But the fight with the C-word actually happened weeks after Martha Ann Alito flew the flag upside down. We contacted the court and asked about that discrepancy, but did not get a response. Based on these brief interactions, Baden says she is skeptical that Justice Alito really had nothing to do with the flag.
He is representative of our entire judicial system, and then we'll go on to make legally binding decisions about the insurrection and, you know, election denialism. It should scare everyone.
In his letter to Congress, Alito said that, quote, any reasonable person would agree that he does not need to recuse over the flag. Of course, what and who count as reasonable can depend on your political perspective or what side of the street you're on. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Construction crews in Indiana are building an electrified highway to charge electric vehicles as they drive over it. Details are still ahead in this hour of All Things Considered. Right now, let's get your Bay Area traffic update starting in Petaluma. Here's Julie Deppish.
And that is a traffic alert for this crash. South 101 before East Washington, a solo vehicle but caught on fire. The right lane taken away, a heavy backup to Old Redwood Highway. Dealing with a hit-run crash in Pittsburgh, Highway 4 eastbound before Bailey Road. That's partially blocking the left lane. And back over the Altamont Pass, big trouble East 580 after North Flint Road. That left lane still blocked with an overturned vehicle. Major delays into Livermore. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Visit Modesto, offering a summer filled with nostalgia and fruit. Visitors can explore farm stands, pick fruit, and experience graffiti summer starting June 5th. More at visitmodesto.com. And from Sutter Health, from 34 joint replacement centers to 5 cardiovascular surgery centers, Sutter never stops helping patients get back on their feet. Learn more at sutterhealth.org. It's 5:30.
It's KQED News. I'm Tara Seiler. The state's highest court has put an end to a decades-long battle between UC Berkeley and some city residents who want to protect People's Park. The university has wanted to build a student dorm and a supportive housing facility on the park, but opponents have argued that it should be protected as a historic landmark of the 1960s counterculture and anti-war movement. Today, the Supreme Court cleared the way for UC Berkeley to start construction on the site. To further explain the case and the ruling, Aditi Bundlamudi from KQED's Housing Desk joins us. Hi, Aditi.
Hey, Tara.
So let's first talk about the case itself. What were the issues at stake here?
So there are two projects in question here. One is the housing that UC Berkeley wanted to build on People's Park, and also the university's long-range development plan, basically a plan to expand the campus to make way for a lot more students. This case stems from a 2021 lawsuit filed by two groups, Make UC a Good Neighbor and the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, which argued that UC Berkeley didn't do a proper job looking at the environmental impacts these new developments would have. More specifically, they argue the university didn't look at alternative sites to build the new housing, and it failed to consider the amount of noise the new developments would have and how that would impact the residents.
Okay, so opponents were basically concerned that noisy college students would move in next door and would wreak havoc. That sounds like a kind of a novel kind of argument against housing, no?
Totally, totally. By law, any housing developer has to consider a myriad of environmental impacts it might bring with new housing. That's according to the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. And noise is considered a form of pollution, but it's only been used in cases where a developer maybe wanted to build on an industrial site or a concert venue. This is the first case where opponents consider just noise from normal people living their lives as a form of noise pollution. The Supreme Court ruled today that they don't agree with the opponents and that the arguments against the project because of social noise just don't have merit.
And so what about their argument about alternative sites? Will UC Berkeley have to do those studies for People's Park in their larger campus expansion plan?
No, they won't. The court ruled that UC Berkeley doesn't have to do that for either plan. And that's in large part thanks to a law that was passed last year that basically cleared the way for this project. UC Berkeley can start construction on People's Park and can move forward with its much bigger plans to expand its campus.
So, Oddity, how are opponents reacting to this ruling? Because this fight has been going on a really long time.
Yeah, the opponents were definitely upset and wish the ruling went their way. The university still plans to keep about 60% of the People's Park land as a park, and they say they'll have a commemorative plaque there describing the history. But there's definitely a feeling of loss still. I spoke to Harvey Smith, the president of the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, who said he's really disappointed.
It's on the National Register of Historic Places. It's a national historic site. So this goes beyond Berkeley. It goes beyond the state of California. It's a national site.
At the same time, there are people who are really excited about this outcome. Right now, UC Berkeley provides the lowest amount of student housing out of the entire UC system. It's only about 22% of the more than 45,000 undergrads and grad students that have access to campus housing. This People's Park project and other housing in the long-range development plan would effectively double the number of beds at the UC.
Okay, thanks so much for tracking this, Oddity.
Thanks for having me.
Aditi Bandlamudi is a reporter with KQED's Housing Desk, and I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from Style Bath & Kitchen, providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower, or bathtub, and more. In their new video series, available on their website by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. From the Asian Art Museum, Phoenix Kingdoms, The Last Splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org. Support for NPR comes from USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. From your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, yptc.com/NPR, and from the listeners of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. 80 years ago this week, Allied forces stormed the beaches of Nazi-occupied Normandy, France during World War II. On the eve of the D-Day invasion, General Dwight D. Eisenhower addressed Allied troops.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Over the years, NPR has interviewed D-Day veterans. NPR's Jack Mitchell searched our archives to share their voices.
For Army Sergeant Thelma Jester, D-Day began with a knock.
Some of the guys came and rapped on our doors, and we went out, and the whole sky was filled with lights from the planes and the gliders taking the troops over to the invasion.
This is Richard Dimbleby speaking from an aerodrome in England on the night of June the 5th and reporting the fact that the first aircraft carrying the first parachutists who are going to land on the fortress of Europe in the beginning of our great attack tomorrow morning are taking off from this air station at this moment right past me.
More than 11,000 planes filled the skies on June 6, 1944. Before dawn, Allied gliders and paratroopers dropped behind enemy lines. Bombers weakened German defenses from above. And at sea, more than 6,000 ships and landing craft sailed toward the French coast. Jim McLaughlin saw the invasion unfold from inside the turret of a B-26 bomber.
I couldn't believe that there were that many ships in the whole world, all headed in the same direction. And then a few moments later, to see that beach.
Troops were crowded into small, narrow landing craft. Captain Frank Walk remembers being caught in strong winds and rough seas.
It was bouncing around.
waves blowing over the side. It wasn't long before all of us aboard that little boat were seasick.
The landing craft dropped their ramps, and more than 150,000 U.S., British, and Canadian troops charged head-on into Nazi gunfire, landmines, and barbed wire.
We finally got into a point where they lowered the ramp and let us out in neck-deep water.
We were scared. I think it was actually too frightened probably to be frightened. We saw guys crying. We saw guys after we got off, they was blowing up.
Some of those who came out with me actually were hit before they got ashore. I managed to find the colonel who was my boss, and he had landed a little earlier. He was no longer capable of functioning. He had been shell-shocked.
I had a bullet that hit my rifle. I twisted it around, and I saw the clean hole in front of the trigger guard. A half inch to either side would have gone through my chest.
Those are the voices of U.S. Army veterans, Private Harold Baumgarten and Corporal William Dabney. There were also reporters covering the invasion. Larry Lasore from CBS landed at Utah Beach with the Army's 4th Infantry Division. He was carrying a typewriter. He spoke with NPR's Noah Adams in 1994.
Did you find yourself backing away from the truth and the horror of what you saw because it was, at that time, too terrible to tell the American people about?
Well, yes, I guess so, because it never occurred to me to tell them about certain things that I had witnessed. It wasn't my place to do so. I mean, everybody would think it was their own son. I didn't have his name. Next of kin had to be notified anyway if a man were wounded or dead. And it wasn't my place.
And now we have taken the most decisive step of the war, invasion of Western Europe.
D-Day was an Allied victory and a crucial turning point during World War II, but it came at enormous cost. More than 4,000 Allied troops were killed during the invasion, including 2,501 Americans. Several thousand Germans were killed or wounded. D-Day remains the largest amphibious invasion in history. Jack Mitchell, NPR News.
As more people buy electric vehicles, states are looking for ways to make the technology more practical and less costly. In Indiana, an experiment is just beginning. Construction crews are building an electrified highway that could charge even the largest vehicles as they drive over it. Ben Thorpe of member station WFYI reports.
I'm standing here at Indiana Highway 231 on the northwestern side of the state. Workers here have cut 85 4x12-foot rectangles in the concrete.
They've dug out a section of the roadway where the electric charging panels are going to go in the road.
Blake Dollier is with the Indiana Department of Transportation.
Right now you can see some of the workers are out here with jackhammers, with things like that.
The brain behind the project is Purdue University's Steve Pekarik. The engineering professor is the lead researcher on the project, and he says the technology could make a transition to electric vehicles more attractive.
If you can have ubiquitous charging, you really reduce the cost of electric vehicles because you reduce the battery size. You reduce the range anxiety, so the adoption rate will likely increase. That's kind of an overall vision.
However, critics argue that the adoption of the technology will be a massive undertaking, requiring cars to be redesigned and large infrastructure investments to be made across states. Pekarik says he knows the technology will need buy-in. His team has come up with a way to make it more palatable. The focus will be on fleets of semi-trucks, because companies might be more willing to make the investment if long-haul trucks don't have to stop for fuel. In Professor Pekarik's lab, the design for the new roadway is laid out on a long table. One set of coils looped together simulates the bottom of a truck. Another set of coils below that is supposed to be the road. And when a truck passes over those coils, it will create a charge. Pekarik says it's like a giant wireless phone charger.
If you're talking about how much power is required for a heavy-duty vehicle as it's moving down the roadway at 65 miles an hour, you're talking about 200 kilowatts. And to put that into perspective, that's on the scale of about 100 homes.
Indiana officials say the cost of the quarter-mile strip of highway is $11 million. Once that roadway is built, Dollier with Indiana's Transportation Department says researchers will look at things like road wear and tear and the effectiveness of the system during different kinds of weather.
Being able to have this go well enough here that we use it in other places, that's something that we're, you know, really hoping we're able to see.
At a charging station outside of the public library in Indianapolis, Jason Hofsetz is getting ready to plug in. He has been using electric vehicles for roughly a decade and has put in some miles.
I drove a non-Tesla from west to east coast.
Hofsetz likes the idea of a vehicle charging highway. Even so, he is skeptical.
It'll take a long time to get us to that point just because I don't trust our usual roads as it is right now. And I say that having blown a tire out just last month on a pothole.
And with basic asphalt highways in constant need of repair, he worries about an added layer of technology. Researchers hope to be able to alleviate those types of concerns. Tests of Indiana's electric highway are set to begin sometime early next year. For NPR News, I'm Ben Thorpe in West Lafayette, Indiana.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott says black voters, especially black men, can win the election for former President Trump. Black voters overwhelmingly have supported Democrats for president, but Scott, who's a leading candidate to be Trump's running mate, says he can help Trump chip away at that lead. Scott's Political Action Committee is spending about $15 million to do just that. NPR's Franco Ordonez is covering the Trump campaign. He's with us now to talk about the efforts and the challenges. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so I understand that you were part of this small group of reporters who met with Senator Scott. Can you just tell us about his plans? Like, what's his pitch here?
I mean, you kind of laid it out pretty well. I mean, Scott is the only black Republican in the Senate, and he's launching a campaign to turn out black voters, especially men, for Trump. Now, the black vote was critical for Biden 4 years ago, and Scott wants to, you know, see on the opportunity presented in polls that show black support for Biden is falling.
There's a lot of reasons why the shift is becoming just so blatantly obvious that it's now undeniable that there is something amiss, and it's real.
I mean, his PAC will lead much of the effort, which includes television ads, direct mail, all the things that you can expect in a full-fledged campaign. Scott is going to be traveling, hosting events in key states like Michigan and Georgia, where they feel they can make a real difference. And the pitch, as you say, is that Democrats have taken the vote for granted, and they argue that black voters were better off under Trump, especially from an economic standpoint.
Huh. But black voters were a key part of Biden winning in 2020, and they've long supported Democrats. So is there a real chance that this block of voters will suddenly switch parties for Trump?
I mean, not as a block. I mean, that's not going to happen. But they don't need that to happen. They just need a few percentage points. I mean, Scott was pretty blunt talking about the vulnerabilities for Biden.
If black voters do two things, some stay home and some come to the right, there is no way to fill the hole. So the coalition that is necessary for the Democrats to have success, period, It's not just black and Hispanic, it's specifically black.
In a recent poll by Gen Forward, which was conducted by the University of Chicago, just 33% of young black people said they would support Biden if the election were held today. 23% chose Trump. Now, for context, 4 years ago, Biden won black voters under 45 by more than 80%.
Right. And that poll you just cited, I mean, it's not the only poll showing challenges for Biden among black voters. Has this push from Senator Scott caught the attention of the Biden campaign?
I mean, this has definitely caught the Biden campaign's attention. I mean, that's why they've been targeting this group with visits and events in places like Atlanta, Detroit, and Philadelphia. I was talking with Cornell Belcher, who served as a pollster for former President Barack Obama. And Belcher says Biden's work on student loans and reproductive rights are real wins for the black community. And he says those voters are not going to jump to Trump. But he also says that he has some concerns that they may not show up.
I'm more concerned about African-American voters sitting at home or breaking third party because that becomes 2016 all again, right? How does Trump win? He doesn't win by addition. He wins by subtraction.
Now, he says Biden could be doing more, but no campaign is perfect 5 months out, and the work they're doing now is really already paying dividends.
And real quick, could this effort by Senator Scott help him earn the VP spot on the Republican ticket, you think?
I mean, to the extent that Scott can grab some of these voters, it's a big deal. And strategists I talk to say it makes him a very interesting VP pick.
That is NPR's Franco Ordonez. Thank you so much, Franco.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The KQED News Quiz is coming up, and then Hall of Famer Grant Hill will give you a preview of the NBA Finals. But first, let's get your KQED traffic update starting in Oakland. Here's Julie Deppish.
And we're on the Nimitz North 880 at 23rd Avenue. Three left lanes are taken away here as they deal with a car and a motorcycle. Big backup to High Street. It's an overturned vehicle on the Altamont Pass. Been there a while. East 580 after North Flynn Road. They're still blocking that left lane. Traffic heavy all the way back to Isabel. And we do have a traffic alert Petaluma, South 101 before East Washington. Solo vehicle crash started a grass fire. It's in the right lane. You're back up starting at Old Redwood Highway. Julie Deppish for KQED.
All right, Julie, we'll have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF. Presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works at the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. It's 5:49, time for the KQED News Quiz Question of the Day, sponsored by Canyon Ranch Woodside. Today's question is, in a bid to spark interest in conservation, people worldwide are creating memes focused on what, according to Here and Now? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio news quiz for a chance to enter to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside.
U.S. presidential candidates agree that health care is expensive, but their ideas for how to address it couldn't be more different. Our series, We the Voters, continues on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED. And this week in KQED Arts, a Latin music festival in San Jose, what to watch on TV this summer, and an Oakland sneaker shop returns, but with a twist. Find those stories and more at kqed.org/arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the NBA Finals, the beasts of the Eastern Conference meet the best of the Western Conference. Although, in the East, the Boston Celtics have been dominant all year. And out of the West, the Dallas Mavericks weren't considered a lock to even make the playoffs, but have been riding a hot streak that's taken them from the fifth seed all the way to the finals. Grant Hill is someone who knows something about a hot streak. He is a basketball Hall of Famer turned broadcaster for TNT and NBA TV. And he joins us now from Boston, where game one tips off tonight. Hi there. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, the Celtics, they've just been killing it all year, and their duo of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown have made it to the NBA Finals before. Tell us what's different this year.
Wow. Well, they have been great all season. And really, the two of them have been great the last few seasons in the regular season and, of course, getting very far and deep into the playoffs. But this year has been extra special. I think some of the moves that Brad Stevens, the Celtics general manager, made this offseason, bringing in Kristaps Porzingis, Drew Holiday, just have been really good, really solid. And they were the best team in the regular season. They cruised through the regular season, and they kind of cruised through the playoffs as well. Obviously, Porzingis getting hurt in the first round. They didn't need him the rest of the playoffs, or at least the next two rounds, but I do believe they will need him here in this series for them to have a chance to win a championship.
All right, so that's Boston. But what's been the big storyline in Dallas? I mean, I know that this team has two star guards who have really seemed to gel and figure out how to work well together.
You know, it's really been quite extraordinary what has happened in Dallas. I mean, a year ago, they made a trade for Kyrie Irving, and they kind of flamed out at the end of the regular season. The Mavericks did not make the playoffs. And they were kind of cruising along during the regular season, but they made a trade at the trade deadline. They brought in Gafford, they brought in P.J. Washington, and they just got hot at the right time. Their defense the last 20 games of the regular season was the most efficient defense in the NBA during that stretch. They won 16 out of 20 games to end the season and just kind of gained confidence, gained an understanding of like what it takes on both ends to be successful. And they've been able to carry that momentum and then ride that hot streak all the way here to the finals. Of course, having Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, two of the best guards, one-on-one scoring players in the league, has helped. But the way this team has collectively defended, this team is really just a matter of getting hot at the right time of the season and being able to deliver.
So, I mean, if you just were to look at this purely on paper, one might think that the Celtics are the stronger team, but how do they match up against the Mavs in your mind?
Well, you know, they played them twice this year in the regular season and blew them out. And it's a little tough. I mean, that one game was in January. One was in March. I think what Boston has is they have length and size on the perimeter. They're an elite defensive team. They have an ability to shoot a high volume of three-pointers and make those three-pointers at a very efficient clip. But then they also get a lot of points in the paint. And, you know, Dallas has been sensational at limiting points in the paint this postseason, keeping teams out on the perimeter, making them shoot three-pointers. So, you know, Luka's had his way, but Boston's had their way against Dallas in the regular season. Now, Dallas is not the same team they were in the regular season. They're a different team. They're a better team. So on paper, yes, maybe the Celtics, because they have home court advantage, because they were the number one team all season and going into the postseason, this will not be an easy series whatsoever. And I think we're going to get an exciting series and a series that could go to six or seven games to determine who ultimately is the champion.
And I'll just note that there are two athletes on the Celtics who will finish the finals. They'll take whatever rest they can get before joining Team USA for the Olympics. And you also happen to be managing director of the men's Team USA as well as a former gold medalist. Are these guys going to be ready to take on the world when the tournament starts in late July?
Yeah, no, we are very excited for the Olympics in Paris, and we have been game planning and strategizing, and certainly Drew Holiday and Jason Tatum, who are on the Boston Celtics, are on the squad this summer. So, but no, we have a great team. We have a team that has a lot of FIBA international basketball experience, and the challenge for us is going to be in a very short period of time coming together as a team, learning the style of play, learning each other, and being at our best when it matters when we get to Paris in the games.
Yeah, I know a lot of us are looking forward to that. Look, I mean, Grant, I don't have to tell you this, but Olympic basketball is no longer a guaranteed gold for the U.S. men. It's not like you can just assemble any dream team, watch them walk all over the rest of the world. I'm just curious, can you give us a little hint of what your guiding principles were in putting together the lineup this year?
Well, I'm glad you said that. I mean, I think sometimes because we have been so successful and at times dominant in international play, we have an arrogance about, oh, we're just going to roll the ball out there and have success. But it's a different game. It's a different style. It's officiated differently. We have incredible talent. I think collectively we have the most talent. Will the personalities and the styles of play, will all of that blend together? You know, it's not necessarily the best players, but it's the best team. And it's like a puzzle. And we'll see later this summer if we're right or wrong. And I'm hoping we'll be right with a gold medal.
Last thing before I let you go, I want to pivot to another topic that's in the news. There's this new FX series that dramatizes the time that the LA Clippers owner was forced to sell the team after his racist comments emerged. I know that you spent your last NBA season with the Clippers before the scandal broke. And I just want to know if you've seen the series and whether it matches what you experienced on the team.
Yeah, I heard about the series. I have not seen it. I do look forward to watching. It was a difficult time for that team and for the players and the coaches that went through that. During the postseason, when everything came out and Donald Sterling and things about what he said were revealed, I do think that Adam Silver, as a new commissioner in his first year, showed his leadership and basically removed him from the NBA. And I think he gained a lot of respect when he did that.
That's Grant Hill from NBA Inside Stuff and TNT's basketball coverage. And of course, he is a 19-season NBA veteran. Grant Hill, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to target and destroy cancer-causing proteins with protein degradation. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at AlignProbiotics.com. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com and the listeners of KQED. It is an